stop the hammering. Stop the hammering out there. Who's got a hammer? Where is it?
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Where's the hammer? Is it on the, go up on the other floor. Somebody go up there and stop the hammering. Stop the hammering.
Cyrus, put that hammer down. Put the hammer down.
Put the hammer down. Put it down.
Back away from the hammer. It's hammer time. No, it's not. It's the Patrick Madrid Show. Hey, by the way, we were talking about baptism and the validity of baptism. And shout out to Deacon Richard Braun on Twitter. Sent me a note. He said, Patrick, to add to the story of the priest baptism, all of those that he had baptized had to be conditionally rebaptized. To which I had a response. I'll share that with you. This had to do with the priest who I was describing earlier on the show today. He was looking at an old, you know, VCR tape of his own baptism, and he saw that the deacon invalidly baptized him. He used the wrong form. I baptize you in the name of the Creator and the Redeemer and the Sanctifier, some such thing. So it was an invalid baptism, and much to the shock and displeasure, you might imagine, for this priest, he realized that he not only had not been validly baptized, that meant also that none of his other sacraments were valid, because you have to be validly baptized in order to receive the other sacraments. And he wasn't. So he got conditionally baptized, or actually he got baptized, and then all the other sacraments were given to him again. So thank you, Deacon Richard, for the comment you made. So my response would simply be this. I don't think that that's true in his case, because you don't have to be validly baptized. And I know that you know this, but for the sake of people listening, you don't have to be validly baptized in order to validly baptize someone else. It's true of the other sacraments, but let's say you are in the delivery room delivering a baby, and the baby emerges in danger of death for some reason. This baby might die. Well, let's say that the doctor is an atheist or Jewish. So he's not Catholic, he's not baptized. And he knows that as a devout Catholic, you want your baby to be baptized. And you say, would you please baptize my baby? And he can do it. He can validly baptize your baby. Isn't that amazing that you don't have to be validly baptized in order to validly baptize somebody else? That's the power of Christ working in the sacrament. So if that non-Catholic doctor were to take a basin of water or a cup of water and pour it over the baby's head, and you tell him what to say. Say this, as you're pouring the water, say, I baptize you in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. That baby is validly baptized. And if the baby dies, then the baby goes straight to heaven. So unlike the other sacraments, which do require valid baptism in order to impart the other sacraments, it's interesting and amazing how the sacrament of baptism itself does not. Let's continue. Let's go to, excuse me, frog in my throat this morning. Let's go to Father Terry in Albuquerque. Good morning, Father Terry.
Yes, good morning. I have something about baptism, but this song reminded me of Bang Bang Maxwell's Silver Hammer came down. So anyway,
yeah.
Sorry about that.
You know who's playing bass on that song? You'd think it's Paul McCartney, but it's actually George
right.
Harrison.
Wow. Man of many talents, praise God.
Indeed.
So I was in the Bronx. I got called into Bronx, Lebanon for emergency baptism. I actually knew the woman, and she went in and didn't realize she was 6 months pregnant. She thought she had stomach pains, mm-hmm. and the baby came out. And so I was called in to the whatever the pre-op room or whatever the baby was, mm-hmm. and it was in an incubator, and it was about 6 months old, and I suited up, put rubber gloves on, used medically distilled water, you know, and I put a drop on each of my fingers, and I mm-hmm. baptized the baby in the name of the Father, and then another drop into the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. That was after I removed the Barbie hat that I was wearing.
mm-hmm.
But anyway, just to mention, sometimes you have to use what you got to use, and it wasn't quite, might have been flowing, but it was at least three drops baptized that baby.
Well, as long as, you know, as long as you can get it done, that's what counts.
There you go. Okay.
Yeah, the church has these requirements, and sometimes it's hard to know exactly where that line is. Like, would four drops have been, you know, certainly valid? Would two drops have been invalid? That's where it can become a little tricky. But I appreciate guidelines, you know, that at least help us know generally.
All right, that's all I got. Well, God bless you.
Thank you, Father Terry. Appreciate the phone call. Let's see. How about Jen in Eagan, Minnesota? Good morning, Jen, and welcome.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you. Sure. I have a question exactly regarding what Father was just talking about. My daughter was born 3 months early and was in an incubator. And I'll admit that a lot of that time is a blur. You know, I had had emergency surgery to get her out. She was 2 pounds. We were living in the hospital pretty much. But we did have a priest come to baptize her maybe a week or two after she was born. And I do have like the bottle of sterile water that he used from the hospital. And I'm pretty positive there was no pouring of water. It probably was more like Father just described. You know, we didn't have a gown on her. She was in an incubator. Her, like, one of us was only allowed to hold her at a time, and that was if she was transferred from a nurse, you know. And so I guess I'm just wondering how sure I can be that that was a valid baptism.
Well, was it more than just merely like wetting, you know, like moistening the thumb and just anointing her head? Was there more water than that?
I really couldn't say. I have the bottle, and it's opened, and there, you know, it's hard to tell that there's even much missing. So
I
had never heard any of this at that point, so I don't know that I was paying a whole lot of attention to how much water at the time.
And this was the priest who did this?
Yes.
Okay. So I think the best course of action is to assume that it was a valid baptism because the priest applied as much water as he thought he could, given her being in the incubator. And so as long as there was some water that was put on her head as he said these words of baptism, then I think you can rest assured that she was validly baptized.
Okay. That's great. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Yeah, none of my conversation today is intended to cause people to be, you know, anxious or worried, but more because some people just don't, and I'm not referring to you, Jen, but some people, they really don't know what is the church's teaching about baptism and what is required. So going through some of these specifics is not intended to unsettle you. I think you have the moral certitude to know that the priest baptized your baby accordingly, even if there wasn't much water involved. Sounds as though there was no question that it was sufficient.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I feel better.
Yeah, I'm glad. Yeah, and that's why I want to reassure you that none of this is intended to make you feel bad. So thanks, Jen. I appreciate the phone call. 888-914-9149. How about Greg now in Las Vegas? Good morning, Greg.
Good morning, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I just wondered what the church's teaching is when a priest invites the congregation to raise their right hand and join him in blessing the catechumens when they're about to leave the church, or a married couple that are celebrating their anniversary. I usually feel uncomfortable about it. I keep my hands folded.
I do the same thing. I understand it. The priest wants the people to feel like they're part of this. I understand that. He wants them to feel as though their well wishes in the form of this blessing, that's important. So I don't knock the intention, but it's not a blessing. So if I extend my hand over you, I'm not blessing you in the way that a priest or a bishop, let's say, would be blessing you. That's an actual blessing.
And right.
Yeah, as you know, and I realize you know this. But, I mean, I can bless my children. I can bless my grandchildren. I could make the sign of the cross on their foreheads, or I could put my hands on their foreheads, and I can give them my fatherly blessing. Parents can do that. But I can't give you my blessing. I can't, you know, I can't give that newly married couple my blessing as they come down. I mean, unless by the term blessing you mean something like just a general, you know, feel good, here's some good vibes, you know, hope you have a long, happy life. Yeah, but that's not a blessing in the sense that the priest gives a blessing.
And right. So, sometimes I get the impression that the priest is trying to make, that there's no real distinction between the priesthood and the priesthood of the believers, you know,
right.
The hierarchical priesthood. And even sometimes the final blessing, may the Lord bless us in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Mm-hmm. And it just bothers me sometimes.
I don't think that formula would be problematic, because if the priest is invoking the blessing on the congregation, I mean, it's not the traditional form. The traditional form is, you know, calling down God's blessings to the people in the congregation. But what you first described is a little bit different from that. So in the first case, if the priest is telling the people, raise your hands and give this person or these people a blessing, it's just, it's not an actual blessing in the sense that a priest or a deacon or a bishop can give a blessing.
Right.
So it's at best just a gesture, and that's all.
Okay.
And you're right, it does have the cumulative effect of blurring the lines in an unhealthy and poorly theological way between those who have the sacrament of holy orders and those who do not. So the men who have the sacrament of holy orders are empowered to impart blessings that lay people like you and me are not empowered to impart.
Thank you. Thank you very much for clearing that up.
You got it, Greg. Always here for you. 8 to 11 Eastern, or so Central, Monday through Friday, right here on Relevant Radio. Let's go to...
That was not quite promo worthy.
Not quite. I'd have to redo that one.
Yeah, you're going to have to redo that.
All right.
When's your show? What time?
Oh, my show, the Patrick Madrid Show, is on from 8 to 11 Central, Monday through Friday, right here on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Oh, that was a good one. I'm marking that.
That was better.
Yeah, that was good.
All right, let's go to Annette in Silver City, New Mexico. Good morning, Annette.
Good morning. I have a quick question.
Sure.
Talking about baptism. When we are going to baptize my grandson, and we are practicing Catholics, and we're ready to baptize. The question is, my son and my daughter-in-law are no longer practicing Catholic. They're Christian, but they're not practicing Catholic. Do they have to go to catechism classes?
So were they ever Catholic?
Yes, of course. They were both raised in the Catholic faith. But at this point in time, they have not come back to the Catholic faith. I'm praying every day for them to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good.
But at this time, they're totally fine with us taking the boys to church, but they're not practicing Catholic.
Okay, well, that's a plus if they're willing to let you do this. So you'll be undertaking to baptize this grandchild, even though the parents are not going to be practicing the faith. Okay, and they will permit you to help raise him in the Catholic faith?
Yes.
Okay, this is great, because very often it doesn't work out that way. So no, strictly speaking, they should be back in the church. They should be back receiving the sacraments.
Right.
But if they're not willing to do so, there's no way to compel them to do that. So you can proceed and make the arrangements for your grandson to be baptized. And then as he grows up to receive the other sacraments of initiation, the Holy Eucharist and confirmation, and teach him how to be Catholic and take him to Mass. This is all wonderful. God will bless you for that. And hopefully one day the parents will come back to the Catholic Church and they can be all united together.
My question is, do they need to go to baptismal classes because they're not practicing Catholic?
I thought I answered that. I'm sorry. No, we can't. The church does not compel them, does not say that they have to do that.
Okay.
They should
okay.
be doing that,
but
the church
that.
Doesn't mandate that they have to do that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, because when I went to the church, the lady at the church said that they needed to go to baptismal classes. And I said, well, when we baptized my first grandson, they did not do baptismal classes. She says, really? She says, you can talk with the father about that, but she said, as far as I understand, they do have to go to baptismal. So that's good. That makes it clear. And I'll just double check with Father. And I'm sure that's what we did last time, because we have two grandsons from them, and they let us baptize the first one. And now they're letting us baptize the second one.
That's great.
And I pray that they'll come back to the church.
Indeed. In fact, I can just imagine all the grandparents out there envying you, you know, that your children are willing to let you do this, because very often the adult children say, no, I don't want my child baptized, or no, you can't take him to Mass. So this is a very fortunate situation that you're in. Yeah, for sure.
Perfect. Okay. I've called you several times. Thank you for everything you do. I have learned so much about the faith.
God bless you, Annette. Thank you. Appreciate that. How about Howell in Wilmington, North Carolina? Good morning, Howell.
Good morning. I'm a bit settled now, and I was never uptight, but I was driving my car, so I missed a little portion of your program relative to baptism. I'm an old person, and I can't remember precisely anything, but I do remember. I think I remember that if we were back in the old days when Catholics were in the military, you know, they still made the sign of the cross at everything. Mm-hmm. We were told that, for example, and I'm not a war hero or nothing like that, so don't misunderstand this. But anyway, if we're on a battlefield and somebody gets shot, heads blown off or whatever, and they're begging to be baptized, and you really don't think there's time to run around and ask anybody if they have a canteen of water or anything, that you have to make a conscious decision. And if you use the saliva in your mouth and you baptize them according to the formula, as you say, then that in your heart and mind and soul and clear conscience is a baptism. Now, I agree 100% with you about priests and deacons taking liberty and varying, because you hear about it all the time, from the order of the Mass or the prescribed formulas for doing things. Totally different subject. And my final thing is the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit. It's there for a reason and a purpose, but you have to make a conscious decision, given certain circumstances, let's say somebody just having a stroke in your car, to exceed it or not. So it's hard for me to I too have grandchildren that have everybody's away from the church. The church is losing people. And we have to have a logical argument about the good reason for having formulas and sticking to them. And also the ability, and so on and so forth. So there you go. I feel better. I'm sorry.
Good. Well, let me offer just a thought for you on the issue of the saliva, okay? So I'll repeat. I don't know if you heard this part when you were driving, but this is from a book called The Sacraments and Their Celebration by Father Nicholas Halligan. So he's giving the church's teaching on what's valid and invalid, and also this regards the law. So not just the church's sacramental theology, but also her law. Here's the pertinent section. Substances which have never been water or have been so changed as no longer to be or to be considered water are certainly invalid. Such invalid materials, wine, oil, meat or fat juice, amniotic fluid, fluids from the bodies of animals and men, milk, blood, urine, saliva, tears, sweat, soup, gravy, grease, lacquer, shoe polish. She goes, it's a fairly long list, but included in this list are bodily fluids. So tears, saliva, urine, sweat are invalid. So I recognize that in a terrible battlefield situation, you do whatever you can and you hope for the best. But the church would say in the case of saliva, if you just, you know, rub some saliva on somebody's forehead, that's not a valid baptism. And my job, Hal, is not to argue with you or anyone else, but just to simply say this is what the church says. And then that way everybody
I understand, but I'll never win over anybody coming to the Catholic Church if they, under those grave circumstances, you say, well, I'm sorry, but this was never valid. I refuse to believe that. I believe that Jesus, God, would accept that because the intent of the heart was there.
I follow Jesus too, and Jesus said, and whoever listens to the apostles listens to him, whoever rejects the apostles rejects him. That's in Luke 10:16. So I'm going to go with the church on this one, Hal. I appreciate the phone call. God bless you. I will be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
Is it taking me back?
Yeah, I like to keep it relevant by playing movie music from the 80s.
That's so relevant to our times. All right, let's go back to the phone. Celeste in Selma, California. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning. I was calling because about 13 years ago, my grandmother, Protestant grandmother, on my paternal side, was in a semi-coma in the hospital, and this was the day before she actually passed away.
Okay.
And my maternal aunts had gone to visit her, and we were in the family waiting room, and at that time, they came out really excited and really happy, and they were like, your grandma's Catholic now, your grandma's Catholic now. And I kind of looked at them with a puzzled, look on my face. And they said, yes, we baptized her. However, she had been baptized as a Protestant. And I was really upset with them because she had always had the opportunity to, she's gone to Catholic church with us at times. My father was a convert. And she had never taken that up before. And here being in a state of semi-coma, I didn't think that she was in a place where she could consent. So I was really upset with my aunts. So my question is, was that valid? And
she had never been baptized before. Is that right?
No, she had been baptized as a Protestant.
Well, then there was no baptism. In other words, if she had been validly baptized as a Protestant, then what your aunt did was meaningless because you can't get rebaptized now.
Right, right.
But here's the thing. If your grandmother was invalidly baptized as a Protestant, and there's no reason to think she was, presumably it was valid, but let's just say turns out it wasn't valid. Mm-hmm. She at least had a desire for baptism, even though she didn't desire necessarily to become a Catholic. Baptism is owned and operated, you might say, by the Catholic Church. As it says in Ephesians, there's one faith, one Lord, one baptism. There isn't a Baptist baptism and a Lutheran baptism and a Church of Christ baptism.
Right.
There's only baptism, and that sacrament belongs to the Catholic Church. So what's interesting is when anyone is validly baptized, he or she is incorporated into the mystical body of Christ and has a connection, however tenuous or remote, with the Catholic Church. So there is a certain theological truth to that, but I wouldn't worry about it or be angry about it, because if she had already been baptized, then what your aunt did didn't affect anything. It didn't do anything one way or the other. You see?
Okay. I just hadn't felt easy about it all these years, and I've been wanting to ask you that question. Mm-hmm. I wanted some clarity in regards to that, so that I could ease my mind in regards to that, because I didn't feel that she was in a state where she could consent.
Right. But here's the thing, though, and I need to come back to this because I think this will put your mind at ease. As a Protestant, she was probably baptized as a child or maybe even as a teenager, because it's pretty common in Protestant circles where they don't baptize infants. Some do, but most of them don't. So if we can posit that she was probably baptized at some age where she agreed to it, well, there you have that she, in her lifetime, she did want to be baptized. So even though she was in a semi-coma when this other incident took place, the fact that she had already in her life said yes to baptism would have been sufficient. So that even if that first baptism was not valid, the second baptism, all other things being equal, would have been a valid baptism. So she didn't have to have a conscious thought in her mind at that very moment, I want to be baptized here and now. If you saw evidence in her life that she loved Jesus, even though she wasn't a Catholic, if she loved Jesus, she wanted to be baptized, or she was glad that she had been baptized, those are all sufficient to assume then that she had the intention to be baptized, and she had given her consent.
Yes, and she was. So that was, I mean, she was very, very religious, very, you know, she definitely believed in Jesus. And
right. Yeah. So I think you can put your mind at ease. Yeah, nothing really to worry about there.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to answer my question and easing my mind after all these years of
that
uncertainty of it.
I understand. Well, hopefully you feel better now.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, and God bless you. And thank you for having this wonderful program for everyone.
Thank you. Well, keep us in your prayers. We sure appreciate that. Speaking of prayers, I want to mention Father Rocky's Advent Inspiration Messages. These are going to be coming to you every single day if you sign up for them. They're free, and they're little inspirational messages in audio form that will start coming to your email box on the first Sunday of Advent, that is November the 28th, and you'll receive these every day. You'll get one each day during Advent, and the reflections will be mailed to you in the morning. It'll help you start your day with a smile and give you something to ponder. You can sign up for Father Rocky's free Advent Inspirations at relevantradio.com/advent, or click on the banner at the top of the Relevant Radio app, and it's free. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Emily in San Diego. Hi, Emily.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yes, I have a question regarding my child. He is a teenager, and he has high-functioning autism.
Okay.
And it's something that it's weighing heavily on me when it comes to trying to teach him things about the faith, because he has trouble connecting feeling-wise with people. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to feeling God, loving him, being near him, providing for him, I'm not sure it comes easy as well. It's even harder. So, so far, he has been going to Mass every Sunday without complaint ever since he was a little kid. Mm-hmm. And he's 16 now, and he is on his way to receiving the Sacrament of Confirmation. Mm-hmm. And this he did willingly. I got to the point where, for me, it was more meaningful if he alone would decide to take the Sacrament of Confirmation on his own will. And I told him, I don't want you to do this if you're not sure about it, if you don't feel it. You are 16 now, and I think you're old enough to decide if you want to confirm yourself in the faith that I've taught you. And as I was saying this, my stomach was tied up in a knot because I didn't want to hear and get a negative response. And I breathed once he said, yes, I want to do it. I want to go through with it. But he seems to always trying to be poking around and questioning God for a lot of things. For him, it's hard to understand. For example, and you know, when I listen to him, I don't have a good explanation either. But when he listens to things about the Virgin Mary and her apparitions and Fatima, for example, and saying things about
suture.
Emily, forgive my interruption. How would you boil this down? It sounds like you have a question you want to ask me. What is that question?
Yeah, he always seems to be questioning God about things like free will. I don't know how to answer his question as well. If Mary appeared in Sodom and she predicted wars and whatnot, there's no free will. If everything is written down destiny, then there's no free will. I don't know how to answer him in regards to that. And also, he doesn't feel anything. He prays, but he doesn't feel anything. I don't know how to help him.
Okay. Well, several important things there. First of all, I'm glad that he answered the way he did. I would definitely not recommend that a parent say to a 16-year-old child, you know, you don't have to get confirmed if you don't want to. Now, if the child were saying, I don't want to get confirmed, that's a different story. But I by no means would recommend suggesting that to a child. Even though he's 16 years old, I would definitely not do that. So for you, Emily, I'm just happy that he said, yes, I want to be confirmed. It's different if somebody insists on not doing it. You don't want to push somebody into doing something that they don't want to do. But to suggest it to them that maybe they shouldn't do that, I don't agree with that. And I say that respectfully. Now, as far as his having autism, of course, this is a situation that God understands perfectly, obviously. And so he's not going to hold your son accountable in the way that he might hold me or you accountable. You know, if since we don't have autism, we don't have this extra burden, this difficulty that makes it more difficult for us to understand God or the things of God, he's not going to hold your son accountable for something that he can't control. So if the autism makes him unable to experience emotions like the things that you just mentioned, you know, I guess that's just how it is, and there's nothing you can do about that. But God is not going to penalize him, if we can use that term, just because he has autism. People who have an illness of whatever type, God takes all that into account because he loves them, like he loves you and me. So what about Fatima? One thing you could do, this would be a creative way to do it, would be to show him the movie Our Lady of Fatima that came out in, I think it was the late 50s or the early, it's probably the late 50s. It's a classic movie. Chances are you've seen it. Remember Ugo?
I've seen it.
The town drunk, you know, and he becomes a beloved character. He's sort of a rascal, but he becomes a beloved character to the children. That's a really great movie. Maybe you could just watch it as a family, and that would help him understand more clearly what happened in Fatima. The same could be true about the story of Jesus. Maybe watch the Jesus of Nazareth miniseries. It's about 6 hours long, and it came out in 1977 or 1978.
Yeah.
Franco Zeffirelli.
Yeah, we've watched it too.
Okay, good. So those are ways that you could help to impress on his mind some of these concepts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the issue of free will, that might take a little more time because it might be more difficult to him to understand that. The fact that God knows all things as he does doesn't mean that he forces us to do either good or evil. And one way that I have found helpful in approaching this topic is to say, let's look at God as God. You know, why does anything exist? Well, it only exists because God created it. Well, why would God create things? If he's perfect in every respect, if he's the sum total of all his perfections, he is existence, he is beauty, he is love, he is all these things, he doesn't need anything. So there's no question God doesn't need company. He doesn't need entertainment, although I'm sure we're rather entertaining to him at times. He doesn't need anything because he has everything in himself to the max, as the kids used to say. So the only reasonable or plausible reason that God created us and the angels and everything else in creation is out of love. And because he has created us out of love, we have to be free to love him in return. If we're not free, we can't love him. That would be forcing, that wouldn't be love. So part of the mystery here about God's sovereignty and our free will is the fact that he endows us with the capability of loving him because we're free. And maybe that's something you can help your son see, that, you know, this is why God created us. Now, it doesn't mean that we understand entirely, far from it, we don't, but we can understand some things about this mystery, that God does know all things, but yet at the same time, he's not forcing us to do anything. He doesn't force us to love him, and so on and so forth. So maybe a long conversation with your son, or maybe break it up into several conversations. That might be a way to go about doing it. I hope that that's helpful to you, Emily. I really do. And God bless you and your family. 888-914-9149. Let's go to a break, and then we'll come right back to your phone calls. 888-914-9149. I'll be right back. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
We are back. Thanks for listening. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Nicole now in Los Angeles. Hi, Nicole.
Hi, Nicole. Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thanks.
Was just calling because I have a question. So I'm Christian, and I grew up a Christian Apostolic Pentecostal in that church with my family. And my boyfriend is Catholic, and we've been together now about 4 years dating. But I recently started going, or I have gone in the past, but even more so going to his Catholic church. And anytime I go, I don't have an issue with it. The person who has an issue with it is my aunt. And she tells me the negative parts of the Catholic church. She says, you know, a church that's going to go to hell, or it's the heart of the church. I don't necessarily know what those things mean, but I do go to the Catholic church to attend with my boyfriend. And when we first started, we both were in church. And to me, and I'm sure to him, it was a matter of, well, we both believe in God and we both want to go to church, so there's no issue with it. So I just wanted to see what your thoughts were on that, because I live with my aunt and it's hard to say I'm going to church and then she asks, and I don't want to lie, but then she kind of gets negative about it.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, you're doing the right thing. Yeah, I want to encourage you to keep going to Mass with your boyfriend. Keep learning. Keep listening to this program, as an example, and Relevant Radio. We'll do our best to try to help fill in some blanks and things. But yeah, that's what I would do. Now, if your aunt makes your life miserable, I guess you always have the decision, do you want to stay there and live with her? That may be, you know, financially a feasible way to do it. Maybe not.
Well, I mean, we're trying to, you know, move out and get engaged and that stuff. But yeah, I mean, I have grown up Christian. It's what I've known my whole life. But I wasn't against the Catholic Church whatsoever. I just felt like if we're dating and we're dating for a purpose, this is a good thing, you know, because we both wanted to be having, you know, a relationship with God. And that's really the only reason why I started dating him in the first place, was because he was involved in church. I didn't care what church. I was just happy that he was involved in it. So now that it's come to this point, a little bit.
Let me recommend something. I think you'll find this helpful. Do you like to read books? Do you enjoy that?
Sure.
I would recommend a particular book to you. It's called Surprised by Truth. Now, full disclosure, I edited this book, but I have a feeling it will help you maybe not only answer some of the questions that your aunt has for you about this, but also it will help you understand more clearly about the Catholic Church. So Surprised by Truth, it has a kind of a reddish cover. It came out in 1994, and it's just stories. It's the stories of 11 people who, in some cases, were a lot like your aunt at one point. They were very anti-Catholic, and they got a lot of their questions answered, and they learned more about the Catholic Church. So if I could recommend that book to you, once you've read that, I think it's going to be much clearer what you're seeing at the Catholic Church when you go to Mass. And also, I mean, like one of the stories in there is by a guy named Tim Staples, and he was Pentecostal. and very, very anti-Catholic. Probably he and your aunt would have gotten along famously. And so his chapter is pretty cool. It's called The Bible Made Me Do It. And it's okay. All very biblical, but I think you'd find it fascinating to read their stories.
And do you think I'm going against what I've been taught my whole life? Because I feel like it's still God, it's still Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, my view, and this is my conviction, and that is that the Catholic Church is that church that Jesus established. So, you know, think about this. The Pentecostal people, Baptists, Lutherans, Presbyterians, Calvary Chapel, all these different groups, they all arose no longer ago than about 500 years ago. Now, Calvary Chapel came out in the 60s, but the mainline Protestant organizations, they only go back about 500 years to the time of the Protestant Reformation. Before that was the Catholic Church, going all the way back to the very beginning. Another thing you'll find interesting is that if you start reading the writings of the early church, you know, in the first century, second century, third century, you find out that they were Catholic, and they called themselves Catholic. You know, they had sacraments. They went to Mass. They prayed for the souls of those who had died. They confessed their sins to a priest. They baptized babies. All of the things that you associate with the Catholic Church, you find those in the early church, and the reason is that the early church was Catholic. So Right. Coming to that conclusion, I know it can be difficult for some, but a book like Surprised by Truth can help you see that bigger picture and give you a lot of scripture, you know, a lot of the things that are important for you to take a look at as you consider this.
Okay. I'll definitely do that. I appreciate it.
Yeah, definitely. And hey, if you don't mind, Nicole, after you've had a chance to read that book, Surprised by Truth, if you could give me a call back and we can talk about what your thoughts are, I'd sure appreciate that.
Yeah, sounds like a plan. I'll go ahead and do that. I appreciate it.
You got it, Nicole. I'll be waiting for your phone call. Thank you. Let's go now to Barbie in Longview, Washington. Good morning, Barbie.
Good morning.
Hi.
So I have a question for you about my sister, who we were baptized as infants and raised Catholic and confirmed the whole way through the whole nine yards. She was married in the Catholic Church, divorced, remarried outside the church, divorced, remarried again. So third marriage in. She decided with her new husband to get baptized in a non-denominational Protestant type church.
Okay.
And she posted this on Facebook and said, "Don't worry, family, I'm still Catholic." So I guess my question is she living in a state of sin? Because I suspect she's extremely undercatechized and also feels like perhaps she can't attend church because of her divorces and all of that. The weird thing is just become a much better person since this time. And so I'm trying to decide if this is really a bad thing. I know it was really just a fancy bath, you know, because she was already baptized.
A fancy bath. So, I've never heard it put that way. That's funny.
Well, that's what I always call it when people do that. But, you know, so I don't know where she stands and if I should speak to her about it, because she has been better. You know, she's kind and loving, and she speaks to me now. And so, you know, that's the
So
question.
God is clearly working in her life, even though she's pulled far away from the faith. And I think your hunch is correct. It sounds to me like that would be a likely explanation, that she maybe fears coming back to the Catholic Church because she's now in her third marriage, and that would be a complicating factor. Now, even that is not an insurmountable problem. I mean, she could, and her husband would have to do the same thing, but she could go through the annulment process for those earlier two marriages to find out whether or not they were valid. So if
most assured they weren't, but I mean, I'm not an expert, but it kind of screams, you know, she got married after 2 weeks the first time, you know, da, da, da.
Let me just share this with you. Here's why I say that.
Sure.
Because that could be a gentle way to invite her to come back to say, listen, you could get this sorted out. And if you wanted to pursue this, you could find out, and it may well be that, I mean, you won't know until you find out, but it may well be that in this marriage situation, if the first two marriages were invalid, you could get your marriage blessed. in which case mm-hmm. you can start receiving the sacraments again. You can come back to the faith again. And maybe that's mm-hmm. maybe she doesn't realize that there's a doorway that she could come back into. And if you were to share that with her, that might get the wheels turning, you know, and help her to that's see good. That she's not locked out. She can come back.
Right. Is she under the umbrella of some kind of invincible ignorance here, do you think?
Only God would know that. I can't say. But, I mean, if she was raised Catholic and she was in any sense paying attention, then I don't think it would be invincible ignorance. Yeah. But
I was catechized the same way she was, and mm-hmm. we were under-catechized. We were that generation, you know. So, I kind of hold on to that little bit of hope, you know. But
ignorance is not bliss. Let's remember in this case, you know, some people say ignorance is bliss, but not in this situation. It's not. So
no, it's not. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Patrick.
You're welcome, Barbie. I hope things work out. And my encouragement to you would be to encourage her to make her way back to the faith and let her know that there is a distinct possibility that everything could be made right. And that may be all that's necessary. Thank you, Barbie, I'm sorry. Thank you. Let's go to Helen in Helena, Montana. Good morning, Helen.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you for taking the call. I was just wondering, I do want to become Catholic, but Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. So I can't get past that when it says the Catholic Church teaches that the church is the way to salvation. Can you please mm-hmm. explain that?
Sure. Let's imagine, you and I, that we were in the days of Noah. And Noah has built this big old ark. And it's not raining. And everybody, as Jesus said, is marrying and giving in marriage and having a great time and going grocery shopping and doing all their stuff. And Moses and Noah says, well, there's going to be a flood. And God told me to build this ark so that I can be saved. And if you want to get on the ark with me, come on. You know, you can get on. There's room. There'd be a lot of animals on there, too. But you can get on if you want to. So then it starts raining. And before you know it, you're up to your neck in water, and there's no sign that the rain's going to stop. Well, if you didn't get on that ark, you're going to drown. So the people, there were eight in all who got on that ark, plus all the animals, and they were saved through water. Now, if you look at the ark, think about the ark for a minute, now, and think about it in terms of the Catholic Church, because I think the Catholic Church is a lot like Noah's Ark in this sense. Imagine how it stank on Noah's Ark. Can you imagine the stench that must have been inside that ark even after one day? Can you imagine how seasick you would have been? What a miserable ride that must have been for 40 days. And the smell and the noise and all those animals. Can you imagine trying to get a good night's sleep on the ark? I can't. When I look at the Catholic Church, and I do believe the Catholic Church is beautiful, and there are aspects of the Catholic Church that are truly beautiful. I don't want to underplay that. But there are aspects of the Catholic Church that are not beautiful, and that's primarily the members in the Catholic Church, I being one of them. So I offer you this analogy to look at it and say, if in fact Jesus established this church as the ark of our salvation, and I believe he did, in spite of its ugliness at times, in spite of the infighting, in spite of the commotion and messiness and all the other things that we could say analogously of Noah's Ark, I still want to get on that ark. I don't want to take my chances body surfing. I want to get on the ark. And I know
how
it may not.
Sure.
That's another very good question. So I have undertaken over the course of my lifetime some really intense study of this so that I can just for myself be reassured in this conviction. Because my parents told me this when I was a kid, that the Catholic Church is the one true church and that Jesus established the Catholic Church. But it came to a point in my life where I said, this is either true or not true, and I have to find out so that I can believe it or disbelieve it on my own and not just say, well, that's what my parents taught me. So among other things, I studied the history of the church. And here's something you'll find. If you go back in time, century by century, if you go back 400 or 500 years, you'll see all the different Protestant groups disappear because the men, and in some cases the women who started these groups, had not yet been born. But you'll see the Catholic Church. And as far back as you go in the history of the church, all the way back to the very first century, you will find the Catholic Church. You will find the popes and the saints and, you know, the sinners too. you'll find the church evangelizing and teaching and celebrating Mass and the sacraments and all the things that you associate with the Catholic Church. You'll find it all the way back to the time of the apostles. Now, granted, in some cases in very seminal form, but it's still there. And so this is just one way that I personally was able to reach that level of certitude, is that I couldn't not find the Catholic Church, however far back I went, to the apostles. And all the other groups vanished over time. So for me, that was a really important test, an historical test that I put the church through. And I found it impossible to ignore the evidence, personally.
Okay.
Yeah, there are other tests.
Well, I'll keep researching.
Yeah, please do that. Please keep listening. I wish I had more time, but I've got to end the show right now, Helen. I mentioned a book a few minutes ago. It's called Surprised by Truth. It is.
I'm going to get that book.
Okay, yeah. I think it will help you, because in those stories, in those testimonies, those people will share with you how they came to the same conclusion. Okay?
Okay, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Please call me back after you've read the book. Give me a call back in a week or two, a month or so, whatever it is. We can pick it up again from there. Thanks, Helen. Well, my thanks to all of you. I appreciate your phone calls, and I look forward to being with you again tomorrow. Please pray for me, and I'll pray for you. God bless you.